Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast
right.
From the Word.
Shall we begin? Are we recording that? Are we okay?
We're,
in the words of Bob Dylan at the beginning of what album is it?
What, is it Rolling Bob?
Is it Ruling Bob? What record is that?
Bring it home.
Nashville
back home.
Nashville Skyline.
Everybody knows it. Nashville Skyline, I'm guessing it.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm not that old. I just read about it. Okay. The first half of this evening's... I'm going to start that again. This evening's Word in Your Ear features somebody who's been on Word in Your Ear in the past, actually, round the corner in our early days at the Lexington, perched on a stool, on a very high stage, if I remember correctly. And he was talking about his book, Isle of Noises, which was an oral history, I suppose, of English songwriters, which... talked to all kinds of songwriters, all kinds of well-known songwriters, and that was very well received. Not as well received, I think it's fair to say, as this book that we're going to be talking about this evening. Walls Came Tumbling Down, The Music and Politics of Rock Against Racism, Two-Tone and Red Wedge, which was so well received that it actually won the Penderyn Music Prize.
Were there any other books shortlisted for that, Dave?
Yes, there were, Mark.
Are you prepared to overlook the fact that yours was one of them and didn't win?
It didn't win.
So if there are any kind of fractious moments this evening, you'll probably understand why.
And the organisers did offer me as a consolation prize and they rang up and asked for my address in order to send me a bottle of Welsh whiskey. Which
you drank in one.
Which is yet
cried in the corner.
But in the words of Spinal Tap, I'm a professional, I rise above it.
Yep.
And we welcome, please, Daniel Rachel. Can we turn the air conditioning off or down or something? We don't mind sweltering. We can hear, that's better. Okay, that's better. Daniel, just as a bit of... We always do this on the Word podcast as a kind of sighting shot, as an opening question. What kind of... music playing machinery was in your home when you were a child? What do you play music on? What did your parents have?
My parents had a record player, a stack system, and now that the stack system was later. In fact, they had a separate record player and an amp, and up until I bought my own first record player, which came after a cassette player, the record player, I wasn't allowed to put on vinyl unless my parent put it on. So,
oh, yeah.
And then when I listened to the end, got to the end of the first side, I then had to call one of them to come in.
No, this is quite familiar, actually.
Oh, really? Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Drove me nuts. We were five kids in the house, as we were. They really didn't want to put on Adam Niant's Kings of the World Frontier
right.
For the 87th time, you know.
So that's a kind of circuitous way of asking, how old are you?
I'm younger than that now.
Because where does your age stand in relation to the events that this book describes? How old were you when all this stuff happened?
When I was at school, I walked into the Birmingham Powerhouse expecting to pogo to the electric guitar of Billy Bragg, but the first person I met was the politician, Claire Short, who was at a stand invited by Billy to introduce the idea of politics to kids like me. And I didn't really know who Claire Short was, and I'm certain I didn't know what an MP was, but I made the connection that there was something to do with politics and music that Billy wanted me to know. And that was the Jobs for Industry tour, which preceded Red Wedge by 6 months. but it was the tour that convinced Paul Weller that the combination of politics and music could be successfully managed in a punk arena, and so he took that idea forward.
So how old were you when you were confronted?
I was a fifth year.
You look sinfully young, year so 11. You've got nothing to be ashamed of. You know, when you were confronted.
No, so I was about 15 when that
you
happened.
You were 15, okay, yeah. Right.
So, at age 8, your parents took a wrong turn in a car and drove mistakenly into a National Front demonstration, which you can still remember, right? I'm sure very vividly.
Well, these are the two. So these are my mic's pulling up my flare. Showing a bit of leg. I feel like I'm on Parkinson's. There's two events that mark why I wanted to write this book. Yeah. So the first one was that event, the Jobs for Industry, Billy Bragg. And the first one was this event when I'm 8 years old. And we were a Jewish family, so with darker skin. And so we were in a Ford Cortina, and we drove into Birmingham and into the city centre, which takes you through Digbeth. And that took us bang into the middle of a National Front demonstration. And I remember my mum vividly screaming, get us out, you know, really terrified. And I think my dad must have spun around the car. I don't remember that moment, but I do remember then looking back out of the window and being fascinated by the colour of the flag, of the Union Jack, that the predominantly, I think would be skinheads, were holding. And the vividness of all those colours really made an impression on me. And then I later found out that the Clash played that night in Barbarella's, because a riot ensued between the police, the Anti-Nazi League and Rock Against Racism, yeah, against the National Front. And the opening sequence of that is on the Clash film Rude Boy. So when I revisited that film, it was all familiar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The two key figures that appear at the beginning of the book, the first section of the book's about Rock Against Racism, you know, are Red Saunders, who starts the wonderful pictures in the book, character on the left there, and of course Eric Clapton, who made this outrageous pronouncement on stage at Birmingham Odeon in 1976. Just remind us what happened there.
He was on stage, August 1976. He asked the foreigners in the audience to put up their hand, and then he told the Pakis and the Wogs to go back home to their own country.
And this is a guy who had two black singers in his band and had just had a big hit with I Shot the Sheriff, yeah, by Bob Marley, which is astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah, transatlantic number one hit, yeah. I Shot the Sheriff, Bob Marley's. And
he was given an opportunity to apologise and never did.
Well, he wrote a letter, in actual fact, which I found, which is in the book, which was published a couple of weeks later in the music press. And he just said that an Arab had pinched his missus's bum outside Harrods or somewhere. Yeah. But he was drunk on the night, apparently. And the style of the way I present the book is through the words of all the people that I met. So there was a couple of witnesses to that gig, of which one of those was Dave Wakeling, who then went on to form The Beat. And he said that this wasn't just a random one-off comment. It was a comment that was expanded upon over the course of the evening, where he backed Enoch Powell, who, of course, had made the Rivers of Blood speech and coincidentally had made that speech literally on the other side of New Street in the Midland Hotel, in which Enoch Powell had called for the voluntary repatriation of black people. And then he talked about Powell, and 2 years later, Eric Clapton was on the front page of the Melody Maker espousing the similar views.
So that led Red Saunders to do what?
Well, Red Saunders at that time was in a left-wing theatre group, and he read the review of the gig at the Birmingham Odeon, and having never written a handwritten letter in his life, decided to do so. And it was signed by the group, the theatre troupe, plus a couple of friends, and it had one critical line. And the critical line was, we need a rank-and-file movement against the racist poison in rock music. P.O. Box, Rock Against Racism. And within weeks, he was inundated with handwritten letters. And that was the birth of Rock Against Racism.
So, and what did he do first? What were the first kind of events? You know, what did he do to take it forward?
Well, I love that idea because you come up with this fanciful idea, don't you? Red Saunders is an unknown person who's tried to lay down seeds in his life, and nothing has taken root, if you like. And so this may be just another one of those things. But what he decides to do is critical. He puts on a gig essentially, and the first gig is Carol Grimes. Yeah, she put a blues.
Oh yeah,
artist.
The Roundhouse. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in a pub in the East End, not far from where Oswald Mosley had tried to work. The Roundhouse came the following year with Aswad, and the critical thing that he very quickly realised with the formative group of about half a dozen people was that a Rock Against Racism group would have a very simple political statement, and it would be a political statement told in action. And the action was a white punk band plays first, a black reggae band follows, which will be a British reggae band, the first we've ever seen in this country. And then at the end of the evening, the members of both bands will be invited to jam on stage for the Raw Jam. And now, I guess, and we take that idea of black and white musicians sharing a stage as commonplace. It's natural. But then it was very rare, you know.
And this was Sham 69 and Misty, is that right? And the Sex Pistols and Lyndon Kwesi Johnson and Steel Pulse with the Stranglers, was that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are amazing combinations.
Amazing combinations. Yeah. And you get extraordinary stories where the David Hines is the lead singer of Steel Pulse and he goes out on tour with the Stranglers, and he's never from being brought up in Handsworth in a Jamaican community, has never experienced the idea of punk, let alone what it means to go on tour with the Stranglers. And he tells an anecdote in shock where he says, we're backstage and the women have got their breasts in the pints and the Stranglers are drinking them. And he thinks that's the most, it's the most outrageous, decadent thing he's ever come across. And he's totally shocked by it. And more so shocked by the
just sheer... another day for the Stranglers.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. but musically, he's shocked by the simplicity of what they're doing, and this is the odd thing, because when there's a marriage that happens between punk and reggae, but where the marriage doesn't happen is musically. I mean, David talks about the idea of 11ths and 13ths as chords. This is unheard of D, A, and E for a punk song. But the marriage, as is so articulated by the various people, is in the schools in the mid-70s, is in the youth clubs, and this is a sharing of records, a sharing of clothes, a sharing of ideals. So by the time the Clash decide to cover Pressure Drop by the Maytels or Police and Thieves by Junior Mervyn, the idea that somebody, a white person in the mid-70s, would want to infuse their songwriting with black rhythms is as natural as David Hines in Steel Pulse or Brinsey and Aswad wanting to infuse their reggae tunes with the pop of the 60s that they've grown up with on the radio, like the Beatles and the Stones.
Well, the major breakthrough was, there's a picture here of the Rock Against Racism office, that's Red Saunders at the back, is it holding up a copy of Temporary Hoarding magazine?
Next door to Finsbury Park Station.
That's right. And wonderfully... synchronicity, we have a police car going by. It's marvellous. Which we've arranged beforehand. But one of the major breakthroughs was the Rock Against Racism carnival in Victoria Park, wasn't it?
I mean, it's brilliant.
Amazing story.
It is an amazing story because this lot, I think this is the story of the book, really, is that they believe they've got this incredible idea. And they try and make events happen, and it swiftly events happen around the country. And they decide to put on this concert, but to their mind, they have X-ray specs.
Steel Pulse.
Steel Pulse, Fitzpatrick, what's his name?
Patrick Fitzgerald.
And the Tom
Gerald
Robinson,
Fitzpatrick.
And the Tom Robinson band to headline. They haven't got The Clash because The Clash won't do it because their manager is telling Rock Against Racism people, we'll only do it. Bernie Rhodes is saying, we'll only do it if you buy a tank for Zimbabwe.
What?
And that's the deal. So The Clash aren't on any of the posters. And so meanwhile, Rock Against Racism, they have to tell the council how many people you're expecting. And they 10,000. So there's toilets enough for maybe 5,000. And the night before, in Hackney, Red and his wife and his friends are making cheese butties and they start filling up the bath because they're going to feed the 5,000.
That's going to be enough, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly.
So how did they react when 80,000 people went to Trafalgar Square and marched all the way?
Well, this is extraordinary. They all go to Trafalgar Square and there's great stories of them, all these coaches coming down from Manchester, from Scotland, from Cornwall, from wherever, and you know, and then they descend on Trafalgar Square, and then they march 7 miles. Nobody believed that an essentially punk crowd would march 7 miles to go and see The Clash, and so they do, and it's a remarkable concert, you know. And in that crowd, right in the middle, is Billy Bragg.
Yeah, his reaction is fantastically interesting, isn't it? Because he realises that it's about discrimination of all kinds. It's not just racial discrimination.
And it's at the moment that the headliners, Tom Robinson Band, who've had the hit 2468 Motorway, that's why they're the headline band. Clash are relatively unknown. And when they sing...
Glad to be gay.
Yeah. Billy, for a split second, says, well, I thought we were here fighting against racism. And then he realises, as he sees gay people kissing, it's the first time he's ever seen an out gay person. And in that moment, he realises this is how his generation is going to be defined. It's going to be a generation defined against standing up for all minorities who are oppressed by, be it neo-Nazis or fascism of any sort. And of course, I think it's Dr. Robert in the book that delivers the great line when the big debate about what did The Clash actually do politically, what did they offer, and Pete Jenner, their manager, is saying they don't got a political ideological stance that they could put a 5p on, you know. They wanted big hotels and flash cars, they wanted to be the people's band. And Dr. Robert says, The Clash delivered Billy Bragg.
The next generation.
Yeah,
really.
Next generation.
Right. So that is a thread that goes all the way through the book, isn't it? Is this kind of tension between trying to use the celebrity of people, and that celebrities have different agendas, don't they? You know, you have to have The Clash because you have to have a star.
Right.
A star is looking for something different, aren't they?
Yes.
They kind of see themselves as bigger than...
But Rock Against Racism don't use celebrity. I think that would be possibly a retrospective idea of perhaps where Rock Against Racism were, because the bands attached to it all the way through to 81, 82 become well-known bands, you know, from the Au Pairs and Sham 69 and Gang of Four to The Specials, to The Clash, Rock Against Racism's big thing was to be grassroots and get bands at the beginnings of their career. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned temporary hoarding. There's one edition says, we need a call out to all bands around the country who wants to play for Rock Against Racism. This is a list of the bands so far that are interested. And 100 bands are listed. And of those 100, and these are all, you know, you can imagine you're in a band in Brum and you're thinking, great, I'll get on the bandwagon. Or The Fall in Manchester, as they do. You know, it's £50, you know, get on there. And yet in amongst that 101 bands or however many, so many of them achieve a status in years to come. Yet that wasn't the, as I say, the prerequisite or the... And it's eventually one of the reasons why Rock Against Racism as a unit of individuals split, is this idea between being grassroots and having a more corporate... a identity that could see them through into the 80s, where the absolute opposite is the Two Tone Tours or Red Wedge, which really relies upon well-known names to promote the idea of what the tours are about.
Right. I've got to ask you a question about a kind of technical question here, which fascinates me. How do you do a book like this? You've got it. I mean, because it is oral history, isn't it? You know, so it's one person talks, and then another voice, and then another voice.
And you talk to
on each subject. So, how many people do you talk to?
It's just over 100.
Right.
I wanted to.
Was it difficult to get them?
No, not really. There's a few difficult people.
Jerry Danvers took a year to decide to do it, didn't he? Isn't that right?
I would have waited 2 years for that man. But, you know, Jerry was incredibly difficult because Jerry cares so much about Two Turn and the representation of Two Turn.
Right.
And it's when Jerry realised I wanted to tell the political story of Two Turn. I mean, just the fact that I learned as a Two Turn nut, I never knew that Jerry had set it up as a socialist record label. And that was fascinating to hear from him. But the way I did it was I wanted to speak to as many people who were directly involved in the story. So whether that's the pop stars of the day, the politicians of the day, or more so the activists. And what you the campaigners. And what you generally realise is that these are people that are trying to do good and not always getting it right.
Mm.
You know, and so...
So what do? You write to all... Say, I'm going to write this book and I'd like to come and talk to you, basically.
Yeah, and then hassle, you know. And
right.
So getting, you know, it was a real thrill to get Neil Kinnock involved. And yet when I went to meet him at the house, because Neil Kinnock was on the original steering committee of the Anti-Nazi League, you know, before he invites Red Wedge into Parliament. I went to see Neil at the House of Lords, and within 30 seconds he had me like this up against the wall. And he was telling me an anecdote about how he never hits anybody unless they hit him first. I was thinking, did you have to demonstrate?
But do you interview everybody at great length and then, what, transcribe everything? Sorry, this is technical stuff, but I want
to... No, I mean, Billy Bragg, I said this a couple of times, that I went to see Billy in Dorset, and we spoke for 4 hours or so.
That's a long time. And then
Billy... But I was really keen to speak to Billy's wife, Juliet. Mm. And Juliet had managed the Selector, who form an important part in the book. And also because I also set out to try and make it equitable between the contributions of men and women. And Julia had also helped to co-run the Two Tone office. So after having spoken to Billy, I then ended up speaking to Juliet for 7 hours. So it was a mammoth day. And Billy would just, you know...
They can all talk, these people.
Yeah, but the reason why I think it was relatively easy is because people were so cared still.
I still want to know. You transcribe it all.
I do. And I'm a typer, like this.
No, okay, but you've got four hours of Billy Bragg talking. Makes a lot of words.
Yeah. No, it drove me nuts.
No, I'm sure
nuts.
It's really good.
So then I transcribed every single interview. So I've got 100 interviews of 10 hours sometimes for an interview. Transcribed the whole lot, and then I went through every single interview and themed it, and then I went across every single interview collating the themes, and then I had a collection of all those themes, and I had an idea.
Did you have it in a wall planner like they do on movies?
No.
Oh, how disappointing.
And then I feels very self-indulgence to about it.
Sorry,
nobody's ever asked me. Actually,
I don't care.
Nobody's ever asked me.
I'm a writer. I wanted to know.
He's put you on the spot here.
No, I love it. But and then, having known exactly what, pretty much what I wanted the structure of the book to be all the way along, apart from where they randomly take you somewhere else, I then began to select from say 30 people talk about the carnival.
Yeah.
Let's get a sequence of events that makes chronological sense. Who's telling the story that actually works? And you maybe get six versions of one story, then reduce that down. And I try to put in as many contradictions as possible. We definitely did that. We definitely didn't do that.
Right.
You did that. I didn't do that. You know, but nobody can argue that didn't happen.
So you don't go back to them and say, now, you told me at great length that you did this in, whatever, 1978. Well, I've talked to somebody else in the band, and they say, no, you did it in 1982.
And those kind of events I corrected, you know, if somebody
you don't
got
go back
muddled.
Right.
Do you know, I was too nervous to...
No,
really.
You're fine.
I did, you know. Okay, a little bit, but...
No, okay. Okay, but that satisfied my curiosity. It was hard work. You've got to do it the slow way, haven't you? But I suppose the beauty is that once you come to put it on the page, it goes on the page quite quickly, doesn't it? Because you've done all the work in the interview.
I guess relatively. I mean, my days were literally, I'd be at it from 8:30 in the morning, perhaps, and I'd happily just go until I dropped. And I'd do that every day of the week. It's, you know, it's, I don't. It's, I was completely and utterly in love with, with
let
the
that
stories.
Be a lesson to me.
Yeah, it was so amazing to hear these stories. And and there's a joy, isn't there? You must know this far more than I do, because I don't have I'm not a journalist. And I don't have that background whatsoever. But but when you feel a narrative coming together, and you feel a history coming alive that's been forgotten about, you know, the amount of people that didn't know what Eric Clapton had done, or continue, as I meet people, not to know, and to feel that you're bringing back to life such an important cultural moment in rock and roll history was so exciting to
to
feel. I'm like, wow, I feel like maybe I'm the first person to know this.
First footprint in the stand.
Could Two Tone have happened without Rock Against Racism, do you think? Do you think that was the platform that helped launch it?
Absolutely. And Jerry says that was one of the formative influences. He set out consciously to form a multicultural band. Now, contrary to what other two-tone people say, he says that in Coventry in the mid-70s, very few black and white musicians mixed. And so he went in search and found Linval Golding, and invited him because he wanted an authentic trebly Fender Telecaster on Specials Records, and invited him to join. Linval promptly left. You know, and he brought in Neville Staple, and his original idea for Neville, which he told me, which is fascinating, was to have a mixer off stage, and Neville's job was going to be to mix live the Specials as a dub live performance. And he said it never really happened, because Neville got onto the microphone while the Specials were playing in Leeds and started doing his patois kind of toasting.
Yeah.
And then the manager, Rick Rogers, who speaks in there, says, you've got to get on stage, Neville, and Neville joins the band. But so Jerry set out a multicultural band. They just toured with The Clash. They saw the audiences that were coming to Clash concerts. They saw the fights, and particularly the Sham Army. And Jerry realized that was an army that needed a positive role model or a way to be from music coming from the stage. So these were deliberate and conscious ideas fed from when he went to see a Rah gig in Coventry that Misty played at, in which his mate, he tells a story about his mate bunked into the gig through a dumb waiter. Imagine the idea of somebody crawling in a dumb waiter.
Great story in the book about the Selector. Used to have these sort of fake fights on stage to diffuse the violence in the audience. They used to pretend to attack each other on stage.
It's absolutely,
and the audience was
incredible.
So stunned. They were going, what the hell's going on?
You know? Absolutely. It's amazing. They would literally down their instruments. And because as you're reading the chapter, the thing I try to do with Two Tone is place the reader in the band on the stage. What's it like to be in the Selector, where you've got one white man, six black people, one woman, a mix of class, people that don't necessarily know each other that well, who are trying to espouse the values of what Two Tone was perceived by an audience to be? Can this actually exist within the bands themselves? That was the question that I was raising.
Yeah.
And the answer is, it was damn difficult, and it causes all manner of fights and problems. So when they down their instruments as a way to say to the National Front, look how crazy it is when people have a fight for no reason and shock them into stopping fighting, they were actually laying into each other every so often for real.
Right.
And it got a bit out of hand, you know. And there's amazing footage of that in the Dance Craze film, where if anybody's ever seen Dance Craze, which is the collation of all the two-tone live footage of band after band after band, and you see this sequence where they do exactly that. And likewise, I mean, the Specials are the band that started it, where there was more tomfoolery in the Specials, but they would bring on fake glasses and bottles, and I'd smash each other over the head.
During Concrete Jungle, that's right, glasses, bottles made of sugar or something.
But when you read about the antagonism that Jerry Dammers was feeling for much of his own band, you view that footage slightly differently. You know, you have to remember that this is a man that when he presented at Ghost Town was being rejected by his own band. You know, they didn't want that. But more's the story that is fascinating that Jerry tells is when he talks about how Rod Stewart and Brick Eklund were the symbol in the early 70s of everything that he and his mates and peers and what he thought punk stood for should never become. So when the Specials became supremely famous, you know, two number ones, successfully beginning, you know, Saturday Night Live in America, and they're getting offered chauffeurs and great hotels, he's saying, no, you know, this is the moment where we don't become Brit and Rod. And the band, Working Class Roots, you know, are you
kidding? Thinking, why not?
Of course, you're saying,
what are you working for?
You know, but have you? How many pop stars have you ever heard eschewing that kind of, you know, what's been laid on for them? And it's an incredible angle that he takes, you know, about the understanding of what money genuinely is. And, you know, and if this is a man talking about people on the streets and people suffering in the way that he does throughout within the lyrics of the Specials, and then you heard that he was living the life of royalty like the Clash were, then suddenly the whole argument is being pulled away, isn't it? Or in danger of just fading into a nothingness. And Jerry held strong, and so it, you know, I said to Jerry, I will not write a two-tone chapter unless you contribute. It just felt disingenuous to do that, you know. And so
this is kind of two-tone at the height here.
This is the two-tone.
It's on Brighton Beach. This was first issue of The Face, I think, this picture was in. So when are we talking about?
Yeah, it was 1980, I suppose.
1979.
Yeah. Okay.
This is the day that Juliet becomes the selector manager. Yeah, it's for Pauline Black's here. This is Barso for Madness, Woody for Madness, who wouldn't do the Wedge tour. There's Jerry. We've got... I think they're the entourage with Neville.
But they were a national phenomenon, weren't they, at the time? That whole thing, that every teenager in Britain wanted a bit of that.
It becomes a phenomenon. I mean, this is an incredible thing that you went for £2.50. You saw Madness, The Selector, and The Specials revolving. Later Dexys would come in.
And probably £2.50 paid on the door as well.
Yeah.
Didn't even get a ticket.
You know? And the extraordinary thing is Rick, the manager of the Specials and the two-tone organiser, kind of makes a comparison between the cost of an album and the tour to now. And it's shocking how cheap it was to see. And within and this is like the idea is to do a Motown review, really. They all go out on the same coach. They do over 40 dates. And Rick's getting out in the middle of the tour on the side of the motorway, phoning up venues. No, it's been cancelled. No, why has it been cancelled? Because we've had to move you to another venue. And he's organising as they go along. And it becomes commercially two-tone. Bigger than punk, you know. These are bands that the Beat, Tears of a Clown, the first Beat single with Rankin Full Stop, sells
these are
quarter
number
of millions.
Number one records.
Number six.
Well, okay, but other
but
ones.
But in December, the hardest market in you know a number six record, you know, and then but Message to You Really, a quarter of a million sales on a single alone. Yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It is.
You know, it's a way bigger than anything really that punk does. You know, and it lasts. And up until the midsummer of 81, the Specials headline the very last Rock Against Racism Carnival in the summer of 91. And I think it's important to remember that much as the raw people who I spoke to talk about handing the baton of Rock Against Racism to two-tone, Red Saunders said, when we saw the Specials, it was everything we dreamed of. But you have to remember that two-tone ran concurrently with Rock Against Racism. And the first phase of Two Tone finishes at the same time as Rock Against Racism does, before, you know, you get into bands like the Higsons and the Apollinaires, and, of course, the end piece of the book, which is the whole Nelson Mandela Artists Against Apartheid chapter.
Yeah.
Again, initiated by Jerry.
Yeah. But Madness start to, you know, take off on their own, don't they? They become a force on their own, don't they?
Well, the idea... When you signed to Two Tone, the idea was you do a single and then you're free to go, no contracts. And that's exactly what Madness did. They do two covers of Prince Buster and then leave to form Stiff Records, to join Stiff. But then there's Cahill, the Chaz Smash is the main contributor here, and he's an extraordinary voice, incredibly intelligent and very deep in his philosophy for the man who was the dancer, you know, and ends up being the trumpet player, ends up writing Our House and Wings of a Dove. But he gets into a lot of problems because that he gets accused of being the racist in the band. He even gets accused by the guitar player of being racist, and it gets blown up by the media, and it's a very troubled time for him. But as somebody says, you know, if you're growing up in Kentish Town and Camden in the 1970s, you're going to know people who were in the National Front. You're going to know people who were in the British movement. And Cahill does. And he finds an escape and an understanding and a release through music. And the way he articulates that is quite incredible, to where he ends up also being on the Red Wedge Tour, but essentially there to promote Greenpeace. This is Rhoda Dacher and the Body Snatchers, seven women. This is quite an extraordinary story, that their own chapter where...
You give them a whole chapter, don't you? Which is very significant, because presumably because they were there weren't very many all-girl groups at the time.
No, you'd have the Slits.
I mean, the Modettes, maybe.
Modettes, the Slits, yeah.
The Raincoats and people like that before.
And Nikki here has been going to the punk gigs, and she's inspired to want to form a band. So she forms a band with Rhoda, and Rhoda ends up recording with Nikki what I regard as the most political and extraordinary, socially political record that exists in rock and roll history, which is The Boiler, which is, as you well know, the recounting of a rape. And the last minute of that record is Rhoda screaming, reenacting the rape.
Which you can't imagine Radio 1 playing these days.
And yet it charted, and Radio
it
1...
It did, oh yeah.
And Radio
it
1 played
really
it.
Well.
Peel played it.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary.
There's a moment at the end, because we should get on to Red Wedge in a minute, but we talked about Chrysalis suddenly losing interest in Two Tone, who they bought and distributed,
yeah,
because they suddenly got more interested in Spandau Ballet and all these other acts that were, you know, in the pop charts and making money for them. Is that right? I suppose it was all just naturally coming to an end.
The music was changing, you know, and as any band changes, doesn't it?
You know,
and you know, you can get into arguments should your specials have released "Enjoy Yourself" as a single,
yeah,
to precipitate, the thing you do before,
prefigure,
and
preempt,
preclude.
Preclude. Over to the audience preempt. For this one.
Yeah.
So tell us about... go on.
Yeah, cut that.
Tell us about Red Wedge. Tell us what... How does Red Wedge start?
It starts with the miners' strike, the women's movement, and Billy Bragg, and lots of musicians who are opposing the Margaret Thatcher government meeting on stages. And when the miners' strike is defeated... by the Thatcher government in the spring of 1985, Billy basically turns to all his mates and says, do we go back to the glossy pages of Smash Hits with our wacky haircuts, or do we actually do something with this momentum? He speaks to Weller, and he crucially speaks to Anna Joy David, and the three of them form Red Wedge. They immediately hold a meeting. Neil Spencer, who's here tonight, who is the editor of the NME from 78, and again a really critical person in the story of reggae and British reggae up to that point, becomes the press secretary. Tons of people sign up. Tim Roth signs up. Ray Davis signs up. You know, and they want to get rid of Margaret Thatcher at the next general election. But the way they decide to do it is to do two simple things. They will try and encourage a youth audience, 18 to 24, to become politicised, and urge that demographic to register to vote. Because in this period, in the mid-1980s, 6 million 18 to 24-year-olds are unregistered to vote, which is a figure equitable to today, just prior to the 2017 general election. And you imagine 6 million kids signing up to vote. That's a revolutionary act, isn't it? So Red Wedge say, we will offer you tours with Madness, the Communards, the Style Council, Billy Bragg, the Smiths, a whole swathe of bands. We will offer you tours. We'll offer you comedy tours. Ben Elton, Harry Enfield, Robbie Coltrane, all these kind of names. In return, politically, from that man there in the middle, Neil Kinnock, we want an influence in party policy. And that's where Anna Joy David really comes into play. And Neil's casts his eye over what becomes the Red Wedge Manifesto. Now, this isn't a pop star manifesto of give us this and we'll give you... This is some really considered political thought, housing, jobs, education. And the amazing thing, talking to apparatchiks around Neil Kinnock and talking to Kinnock himself and Angela Eagle and Claire Short and Tom Watson, all who play and figure in the story in some way or another, Kinnock says that when the Labour Party drew up the papers for the 1992 government that wasn't, the Red Wedge ideas were there in black and white. They'd been formulated by Gordon Brown, who at that point was industry, trade and industry, which is very important, trade and industry. The ideas of Red Wedge are there. And so this is, you know, in the history of Red Wedge, they're discarded because with the headline, Billy Bragg lost the 1987 general election on his own. Therefore, Red Wedge is a failure. That's nonsense.
Did the Labour Party...
Pete Jenner.
This is a picture of the touring entourage, which is just extraordinary, isn't it? Because the most famous person in this picture now went on to be Dave, a vicar,
a Church of England vicar. Now featuring on Strictly Come Dancing,
the rocking vicar.
So it just shows how you never know how things are going to work out.
And a director of Red Wedge was Richard Coles.
Yes,
Jerry Dammers with no teeth at the back. What's her name? The poet from
Jules.
Jules the poet. Yep. And she tells some incredible stories. What's it like to be a woman on stage? I've been spat at, I've been bottled, I've been sexually assaulted. I mean, she goes into great detail about women's plight, and particularly her role within Red Wedge. Red Wedge then put on the women's tour. This is, again, groundbreaking stuff and a history that has been totally forgotten. And it was exciting to bring it back to life, to say there was a women's tour. Sandy Shaw was on it, backed by Johnny Marr, the only man allowed to play on the tour.
And refuses at one point to turn up. She says she threatens not to come and play. What was that about?
Who knows? Yeah. but somebody's pleading. You know, the girl from Sensible Footwear is pleading on the phone, and up until the moment she walks on stage, never knows if Sandy will appear. And there's this incredible bill with Tracy Thorne, you know, where she goes on the tour, and the moment that Glenys Kinnock, just before, she's admiring Glenys's Red Rose, the new Labour Red Rose, and Glenys gives it back, gives it to Tracy before she goes out at Nottingham. And then as she comes off the stage, she gets the badge back. Tracy can't keep it.
Right. I don't know if you mentioned this earlier. I mean, did this culminate in some way in the Mandela concert? Was there a connection?
Well, this is the thing that Phil Jupicus talks about in the book, you know, as was Porky the Poet, where what was the greatest political record ever that this country's had? First, it has to be Do You Think It's Christmas, because of the lives it saved and the millions it generated. Second, it's Nelson Mandela with the chorus Free Nelson Mandela, performed by the Special AKA, written by Jerry Dammers. So Jerry writes that before Live Aid and starts to put on and establishes and starts to put on Artists Against Apartheid concerts. The first one, 250,000 people on Clapham Common, the single biggest demonstration against apartheid in the world, I think. That leads to this event in 1988 and then again in 1990 at Wembley. And I think it caused a chronological problem within the book, because it means going back in time to tell a story that ends in 1990. But what I really wanted to do for the reader was to say, here at the beginning was Clapton, Wogs and Packies Go Back Home. Here we are in 1990. Nelson Mandela stands on that stage with his fist aloft. He's a free man. his country isn't free. That's to come within another year or so. And the reason he's there is because these are all pop fans, you know, and they all celebrate with the encore of the song Nelson Mandela. And what an extraordinary thing that a youth generation, this is the argument I try to make, is being flipped from the casual racism of Alf Garnett, of the black and white minstrel show of, is it Bless This House, Bless Thy Neighbour?
Love Thy Neighbour.
They've been flipped from that, and the casual race, the derogatory comments about women, the anti-gay comments, and whatever else existed in the 70s, has been flipped to the end of the 80s, where of all the mad things, pop music has made it hip to be anti all these things and provide us today, I think, in many ways, with a society. I think it's Robert Elms that most eloquently says this in the book. But we now have a society that is so much more liberal in terms of gay rights that the au pairs were talking about, and Tom Robinson, in terms of black and white coming together, in terms, you know, all these things. We still have problems. It's not a rosy thing. I mean, we also go back, don't we? But this generation that I define as 16 years. It is utterly extraordinary, you know, the idea of politics and music generating and harnessing and bringing in 600 million people watch that concert, watch a pop concert about politics, essentially. It's extraordinary.
Two final questions. One, when are you running for office? Seriously. No, you're not? Two,
I've avoided offices all my life.
Two, if anybody wants to buy your book, can they buy a copy off you? They can do that.
They can. They can buy that, or they can read about my previous one with Chris and Glenn in Isle of Noises.
In Isle of Noises. Thank you very much. It's been absolutely enthralling. It's an enthralling book. Daniel Rachel.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, David.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.